This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 216, and unless something major goes wrong, I am done for the week. Yay! My poor little brakes are grinding a little bit. Got a lot of dust on the new road because we put down some gravel last week. That all went fine. We actually ended up using less gravel than we thought. At one point, we thought we were looking at 5 loads, and turns out we only needed 3 loads plus the load we're getting tomorrow to finish up. And at $240, $250 a load, you kind of like to use less if you can and still do a good job, which we ended up only using 3 on the main drive, and then we're just going to use 1 more on the short drive. So it's fun having my son-in-law out there, you know? We can confer on things. Of course, it was really good to have my buddy out there for all those years, too, because we conferred on a lot of things as well. So it's just time moves, time changes, you know, life goes on. Thankfully, I am getting together with my buddy for 1 breakfast a month. That's about what we can swing at this point, but at least it does give a chance to touch base and see how everything's going. In fact, I think maybe this Thursday I might be getting together with him. Would that be right? This Thursday, 23rd, 23rd, 16th, 14th? Yeah! Yay! Next Thursday I'm getting together with my buddy. Anyways, okay. Everything else is puttering along. I am supposed to have waiting for me when I get home the proof copy of Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame. Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame. It's really good to work with good tools. Wow. Man, it's good to work with good tools. I finished up my final read-through. I was getting a little nervous. I told people I'll probably have these books ready by 3rd or 4th week of May. And then I was thinking, man, I'm not going to meet that deadline. And then I just got finished with my final edit and started pouring it into Adobe Suite's Creative Suite InDesign. Started pouring it in, started knocking it down, and you know, I already knew kind of what the cover was supposed to look like, and I had the pieces for that, put it together, and I mean, it just goes bang, 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 and goes together. And you export, and it's beautiful, and boy, it's good working with good tools, you know? It's good, it's good. So that went well. I have the title of the third book in the series, and the final book in this series that I'm going to write for a while. There are more behind it, but I'm going to toddle off and work on another series because I should be at a good closing point once I get the third book done. I think the title for the third book is going to be Amanda and the Cog-Shifting Imp. So that should be fun. I've got, the ideas are percolating now. It's so interesting because creative process, at least for me, when I'm working on one project and I know there are some coming other projects behind it, and I look forward, it's just all sort of a fog. But then I get that project done and then I start looking forward again, and suddenly it's like I get start getting pieces, and oh yeah, I could do some of that, and oh yeah, I could do some of that, and yeah, that would be cool to have that in there. And this whole creative process is really a wonderful, wonderful thing. I highly recommend it. Because as I've said before on other podcasts, I really do believe that the creative process puts you in touch with something that is beyond yourself. That as you move through the creative process and you have those flashes of insight and you think, oh, I could do that, or oh, I could do that, that the way they come out of nowhere gives you this feeling like there is more going on. under heaven and earth than you can imagine. And that's cool. That's cool. I was reading many years ago. I was reading a book where the author of the book was trying to explain away that feeling that you have. And she said, yes, I know it really feels like something is happening outside yourself, but it's not really that. It's down in your subconscious that that's all coming from. Okay, well, who's to say that down in that subconscious is not where God speaks to us? So, anyways, very interesting. All is progressing well. As I mentioned last week, we did have to put to sleep our last dog last week. That obviously was a traumatic experience for my wife, but you know, I did go home and spend some time with her with that. I did work a little bit in the afternoon, but it gave us a chance to be together during that, everything went well. The staff at the veterinary hospital was very kind, and it's always just amazing to me to watch it. I mentioned this back in February when we had put down Abby, our older dog. It's just amazing because Temple Grandin, there was a movie that was based on the life of Temple Grandin, who was Asperger or autistic or something, but was very good at working with animals. And she was watching the slaughter of cows, and her response was, where do they go? One moment they're alive, and then they're not. And it's so fascinating to see that, where, you know, they give Andy, our youngest dog, the injection, and he's got his head up. One moment he's there, and then you can just see him fade, and he's not Andy anymore. You know, it's just done. The other thing that always I'm reminded of when I'm in one of those situations where there is death involved is that life really doesn't have a recoverable off switch like the things that we build do. You know, you turn a light off, you can turn the light back on. Life isn't that way. Life turns on and it turns off once. And that's it. At least for this life. So, it's very interesting. Very interesting. I had mentioned last week that I had finished up a book called Pandora's Lunchbox. It was written by Melanie Warner. Really interesting book. And I'd said that I would probably be talking about that this week. I do have lots and lots of sections from the book. The book is many pages. I am not going to quote the book verbatim, obviously, because I don't have time for that. And I'm not even really going to try to talk about all the issues that she talked about, but just some of the things that struck me as I was reading it and have either reinforced or caused me to make other resolutions in my life over what I will eat and what I will attempt to avoid eating, although sometimes from the perspective of hospitality and graciousness, obviously, if food is put in front of you to eat. You know, some of these new resolutions will be set aside in favor of kindness and graciousness. But it is pretty interesting. It is pretty interesting. So, as I recall, Melody Warner was saying the reason she decided that she would write this book in the first place was because she had started a practice for something. I can't remember what it was for, but she had started a practice of taking food, processed food, and putting it in a bag and leaving it in her office just to see how long before it went bad. Or just leaving it in her refrigerator to see how long would it be before it went bad. And she was noticing that a lot of this processed food just went on and on and on. Mold wouldn't grow in it. Bacteria wouldn't grow in it. And that led her, I think she was doing an article or something, and that led her to decide, I'm going to really kind of check this out. And so it led her on the path of trying to find out just what are all of those additives that you see listed on the ingredients list on the back of these processed foods. And one of the additional things that she turned her attention to, one of the things that I found fascinating, was the idea of vitamins. Because we are all told you should take your vitamins. And we have all been told about studies that show how much better it is for you to have certain vitamins. As I have been going along in life, I have come to realize that, in fact, a lot of these studies that talk about getting the appropriate vitamins and minerals in your diet and show how beneficial that can be really aren't talking about synthetic vitamins. What they're really talking about is eating foods, real foods, that are rich in those vitamins. And so it was fascinating to me, and I personally did just stop taking vitamins several years ago after I kind of realized that all the studies that show, for instance, vitamin C is good for you, really are based on vitamin C that you get from real foods. And so it was not too much of a surprise when she started talking about synthetic vitamins not being proven to be as good for you as eating fruits and vegetables and real fruit that God has designed. But what was a surprise to me was the process by which these synthetic vitamins are created. I guess I just assumed all along that vitamin C, for instance, was just distilled down from lemons or limes or oranges or something, and in fact it isn't. These chemicals that they are creating, these isolated synthetic chemicals, in fact, go through multi-step processes, some as many as 40 steps. She was talking about the process of creating ascorbic acid, vitamin C, and she said it consists of about 10 steps, out of which there are sub-steps. She said it starts not with corn kernels or even corn starch, but sorbitol, which is a sugar alcohol naturally found in fruit and made commercially by cleaving apart and rearranging corn molecules with enzymes and a hydrogenation process. She goes through all these steps that they go through, including one that where things are fermented and then they have to give it this bath, where they treat it with hydrochloric acid to form crude ascorbic acid, and then finally that's filtered and purified and milled into a fine powder, and it's ready to be shipped off and mixed with other nutrients and added to your cornflakes to fortify them, because in the process of making your cornflakes, they basically beat all of the nutrition out of them so that they would sit on the shelf for 6 months without going bad. And she said, really, when you're talking about looking for a description for this, fermented corn might be the best description. She did say, as part of this section, that but while studies routinely show that various fruits and vegetables are effective in warding off modern ailments like cancer and heart disease. The same can't be said for synthetic vitamins. She did mention that there has been one recent study that does seem to indicate, there has been one that stood apart, does seem to indicate that taking a multivitamin a day might improve your chances of not getting cancer. But there have been other studies that have been done. There was one study, I think, that was done on vitamin E, where they gave men vitamin E to see if that would increase their chances of not getting prostate cancer. And in fact, they had to stop the study because it increased the chances of them getting prostate cancer. And enough men started coming down with prostate cancer in the study that were significant, statistically significant, that they stopped the study. Very interesting. Very interesting stuff. And she went through a whole bunch of other chemicals that are used to create these vitamins and how that these chemicals by themselves are toxic. And that she was talking about, It was azodicarbonamide, I don't know, something like that. How when a truck full of this turned over in Chicago, that they like evacuated and, you know, blocked off the expressway, blah, 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 blah. This is what they're using to process some of our vitamins with, these kinds of chemicals. I don't know about you, but I don't necessarily want that stuff in my body, even if it is just residue. She did talk in another part of the book, another one of those eye-openers, that there are roughly 1,000 ghost additives on the market. And she started talking about this thing called GRAS, G-R-A-S, and it stands for Generally Recognized as Safe. That this GRAS idea came about because the FDA, people were having to file all this stuff with the FDA, and so, you know, at some point, they decided, they established a law, sort of a little program known as Generally Recognized as Safe, so the businesses wouldn't have to file for everything. You know, everyone and their dog recognizes things are safe, like spices and salt and vinegar and yeast, you know, that generally recognized as safe. So what would happen at that point is companies would petition the FDA to just mark this off as generally recognized as safe if they had their own scientists look at it and the scientists went, yeah, okay, you know, it's fine. Well, after a few years then, the FDA came back and instead of petitions, they changed it to notifications. You know, as long as your scientists look at it and they say, generally recognized as safe, you know, that's okay. So, this guy was doing research and he discovered that a lot of these panels who review this at businesses, some of them are a panel of one, and there was one instance where a single person had served on 185 different panels. Panel of one. He went, yeah, it looks good to me. What can happen is that when people, you know, when businesses actually file for approval for evaluations with the FDA, if the FDA comes back and says, you know, we're not going to approve this, they give the company an opportunity to withdraw their notification. And if they do withdraw their notification, then they can either drop the ingredient, which the writer of the book was saying that's unlikely they'll do that, or do additional investigations and resubmit to the FDA. Or they can just declare the item safe and just start selling it. Which I had no idea that they could do that, but apparently they can. So, she mentioned in the book that that just applies to items that are actually going in the food. None of this applies to what are known as food contact substances. And by the way, at this point, there's something like 5,000 ingredients that are going into food. But none of those are the whole additional category of food contact substances that do not have to be tested. Things like stuff that's used on the plastic bags or in the cans or in all that sort of thing. And Melanie Warner documented in her book a time when customers started calling Kellogg's toll-free line and complaining of nausea and diarrhea and a noxious waxy odor emanating from cereal boxes. The cause turned out to be elevated levels of an unstudied chemical called, oh boy, here we go, methylnaphthalene. That's a breakdown product of various chemicals used in the wax lined cereal bags. One moment, I'm getting my mail. And so Kellogg had to recall like 28 million boxes because there's no testing. That was in 2010. And there's all kinds of chemicals like this that are used in the packaging of food things that, you know, they aren't really tested. And even when the FDA decides that something really should not, it's not good, a lot of times they just ask businesses to slow down on it. For instance, she documents a case in 1991 where the FDA asked bakers to stop using potassium bromate within 2 years. But there was no mandate, and so people just kept putting it in their stuff, even though it was recognized as something that could be harmful. And she said it took almost like 10 years before businesses finally enough business started cutting it out. She said, according to her stuff, that even in the early 2000s, it was hard to find any bread that didn't have that chemical in it. She said there was a incident in 2006 where the beverage industry acknowledged that when ascorbic acid, vitamin C, and either sodium benzoate or potassium benzoate were combined under certain conditions that small amounts of benzene were produced, which is a substance that's known to cause leukemia and other cancers. She said this occurred in products like Sunkissed Grape and Orange, Kool-Aid Jammers, Orange Drinks, Crystal Light, blah, 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 blah. The solution in many cases was the addition of another chemical that could blunt the formation of benzene. The preservative calcium disodium, EDTA. So, yeah. She did mention at one point that I thought it was interesting. She was choosing a preschool and she was asking our daycare center. And she was asking them, what do you feed the kids? And they said, oh, we use only healthy food. Really? Yeah, we do very healthy chicken nuggets. They're very healthy. And she said to prove it, she handed over a binder detailing some of the commonly served foods. She said the list of substances used to make the chicken nuggets stretched across 10 lines and included BHA, methylcellulose, the preservative propyl glycate, and soy protein, which is decidedly not white meat. And it looked like someone's idea of the cheapest nugget they can make while still convincing people that it was healthy. The other thing that was interesting was she went into the soybean factories where they make soybean protein. We've all heard about the soybean protein, how it's a wonderful substitute for protein and all that sort of thing. And she said that for the past 5 decades, she said this extraction of this soybean protein has been done with a solvent that requires, or no, soybean oil, has been done with a solvent that requires soybean oil factories to be explosion proof. because the chemical is so volatile. Hexane, I think, was the nemyl. She said, it comes from the same fraction of crude oil that's used to make gasoline. But they use this hexane because it's so much more efficient in extracting the oil, the soybean oil. She said there was, in 2003, a manufacturer's malfunction in one of the plant's ventilation system that causes gases from the vats of hexane to accumulate and ignite, killing two workers and injuring six. Yeah. You know, it just goes on and on and on. The other thing that's interesting, by the way, about soybean oil is that it's out of balance when it comes to omega-6 versus omega-3. And what we do know now is that you really should not get too much omega-6 in your diet because it interferes with the absorption of omega-3, which is the really good fat, which you get from olive oil and walnuts and salmon, those types of things. The other thing that I really found fascinating is that apparently the government has a program whereby schools can get free meat to cook for kids. But instead of taking delivery of that free meat, they can send it to a food processor like Tyson, who then takes that free meat, infuses it with the soybean protein, you know, and all kinds of other filler stuff, and then it can sell it back to the school cheap. And that's one of the ways that schools, public schools, stretch their food budget, is they divert their truckloads of these chicken over to processors, and then that way they can feed more. It was really interesting when she was talking about going to these... When she was talking, that's the other thing. She said there used to be an FDA rule to limit vegetable protein in product in school lunch meats to no more than 30%. But after lobbying, that was removed in 2000. So there you go. They can put as much of this stuff in it that you want. So then she talked about going into one of these factories and having to wear these rubber boots. She said, in terms of soybean conversion, she said, I understood why I was wearing rubber boots. The surface under our feet was slicked with water and dotted with occasional puddles of thick, foamy, yellow slurry dripping from a pipe. It smelled as if someone had taken animal manure and combined it with a pile of aging meat and old wet socks. If I closed my eyes, it would be easy for me to imagine a cattle feedlot, not a facility for making the primary ingredient in infant formula. So, of course, when they run the soybeans through all these acids and things to extract the oil, the problem is that what they get out stinks. So then they have to run it through all these other things like sodium hydroxide, which can cause blindness if it gets into your eyes and is most common household uses as the active ingredient in Drano. Food manufacturers often address this by using what are known as soy-making agents, flavorings that either neutralize or cover up those wet socks or whatever other funk might emerge. Okay, well, but as she points out in her book, none of these companies are inherently evil. They're just trying to make as much profit as they can. She did tell a very interesting anecdote about a woman who became the CEO of PepsiCo. She was the first woman and first Indian to lead the company, and she took on nutrition as one of her defining issues, seeking to recast what a food company should be. You know, she started talking about drinkable snacks and snackable drinks and, you know, trying to get more healthy and that sort of thing. And the company, the investors in the company and the bottlers freaked out when she started focusing on trying to get things more healthy and not focusing enough on the flagship products. And in March of 2011, The trade journal Beverage Digest reported that Pepsi-Cola, the flagship brand, had slipped to the third most popular beverage in the United States, with Diet Coke usurping its number two spot. Regular Coke was still the leader. This was a major upset in the beverage world. And Ann Gerken, an analyst with the investment firm Davenport & Company, knew exactly why it had happened. Quote, "A good amount of weakness stems from the management's increased focus on its better-for-you portfolio." So, of course, when that happens, everybody starts getting upset. And, of course, the CEO goes back then and starts pouring money in, pushing the major brands. And Melanie Warner reported that as of the fall of 2012, PepsiCo's North America soda sales were showing signs of an initial turnaround. The moral of the story was clear. For a company like PepsiCo to have downplayed some of its biggest sellers, whether intentional or not, was nothing short of financial recklessness. These companies that have built up this approach of how do we get it to sit on the shelf longer, how cheaply can we make it, and how can we get people to consume more of it. Once you're on that path, it's really, really hard to get off that path. And it's interesting because some of this is thematically similar to what Farforth Fables 3 is going to be about, Amanda and the Cog-Shifting Imp. And that it's going to be about control and the mechanisms of control and how that as we pursue more and more control over our environment, over our situation, that the control that we pursue ends up controlling us and ends up confining us and systematizing us to the place that we begin serving the control as opposed to the control serving us. All of this to say, we as consumers have the choice as to what we want to consume. Free will. You want to consume processed foods, those kind of things, you're welcome to do that. It's free will. That's the great, great thing about this life. But be aware that those products that are getting created for a specific reason. They are getting created so that they can sit on the shelf as long as possible, so that they can be made as cheaply as possible, and so that they can convince you to eat more of them and consume as much as possible. It's very, very interesting. Highly recommend the book, Pandora's Lunchbox by Melanie Warner. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.